Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Coming up on the free-for-all, Tom Parada, who might be the only happy man in England right now because he's over for the Journal covering Wimbledon. Let's talk about Novak. Let's talk about Serena. Coming up, free-for-all.
This is free-for-all from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is your good friend Jason Gay, and thank you for joining me once more on the free-for-all. Jim Chirusmi is on strike. I think basically Jim Chirusmi is on some sort of strike. I haven't heard from his agent. He hasn't given any sort of indications as to what it's going to take to bring him back to the chair, to the table here at the free-for-all. But I am hosting this podcast from my beautiful home, which is currently unoccupied by my children. It is so quiet, you can hear a mouse tweet. And on the line over in merry old England, or not so merry old England, is Tom Parada, who is covering Wimbledon for the Wall Street Journal. Tom Parada, the great tennis journalist for the Wall Street Journal. But Tom, before we get to the tennis, I mean, you're in England, and England just feels like the center of the universe for bad things happening. First, the Brexit vote, and then England loses to Iceland in the Euro Cup. I mean, what is it like? Is it just a giant rain cloud over there?
Well, it did rain today, in fact.
And it did rain, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a quote in a story we were going to have in the paper, not one of mine, in which someone says it's the worst time to be English since the Second World War, which is exaggerating, but they're a little out at the moment, for sure.
What was the situation on Monday with the game? Like, were people watching the game from Wimbledon?
They were, and they were just flabbergasted. I mean, the British reporters were excited at first, and then quiet, and then devastated, and then it ended, and it was rather unbelievable to everybody. The foreigners, Americans, and people from all sorts of other countries looked on it as sort of a curiosity, an amazing curiosity, like, wow, another thing, another disaster. It's incredible how these keep happening.
But it must be, I mean, you've been covering this tournament for what now, 11 years straight?
I've been here since 2005. I missed one. In that
you missed one. So, why did you miss one, Tom? Don't give me some excuses.
Why did I miss one? The birth of our first child.
Oh, that's such a lame excuse. But is the mood any different? I mean, given all the circumstances, things that are happening in the country right now?
Not really on the grounds that I can see. The place is full. The fans are into it. A lot of the fans are tourists. You know, the queue is really full. People are lining up. It's a good year to get tickets, actually, because the prices, you know, if you're an American coming over here, the tickets are a little, they're considerably cheaper than they used to be.
Can I ask a dumb question? Can you still buy a ticket for Wimbledon, like now, with the tournament underway?
Say that again. Yeah, you can. You can. If you can wait in line at the queue, and you'll get a ticket. Or there's debenture holders who, you know, it's essentially a seat license, although it's more like a stock. And they'll, you know, sell them off. Perhaps they're not going to go as many times as they thought because they just lost, you know, a significant amount of money and whatever else. So they're going to sell off a few more available to brokers or whatnot. I mean, you'll still pay a pretty penny for them, but it'll be less than normal because the rate is much lower.
Now, when you say the queue, you mean, of course, line, and how long do you have to wait in line for?
Oh, it depends. You know, the volume can change, but a lot, you know, you do sleep overnight there a lot.
It's at a park now,
which is quite nice. You can bring a tent and you can barbecue, and people make a great time out of it. It used to be on the road. I remember talking to old queuers years ago. It used to be up on the road, and it was a narrow sidewalk, and you'd sleep, and the cars would go buzzing by your head, essentially. So it's much better now. So there's that.
Yeah, it sounds great. Well, you do get a ticket at the end of it, so I guess there is a reward. We're into this tournament, Tom. Day one in the books, day two. Did you get
You got a few matches washed out, right?
Yeah, things were basically stopped around, I think it was 3, 4 p.m.-ish here. Started to rain and really never recovered. So they finished all the matches on center because of the roof, and they moved one other match to center to get that done. But there's a bunch of matches that either didn't get started or were, you know, just starting and had to stop.
Do they pull the plug as soon as it starts to rain, or will they let it rain a tiny bit just to sort of see what happens?
They'll finish a game or a few points under a little bit of rain, but it's not like the French Open. Yeah, the clay absorbs the water, the grass.
Yeah.
If it gets wet for a few seconds, it's pretty slippery.
Yeah, yeah. What is the deal with the hard court? Will they let it rain for a second on hard court, or do they pretty much end it there too?
They'll let it rain for a couple seconds, but the players will get very upset, and then they'll stop.
All right. Well, after the French Open that you had, Tom,
you don't want to stop.
You don't want a lot of rain this time, I'm assuming.
No. Well, they have the roof, so they'll get the tournament done. It might require people playing, you know, many days in a row.
Yeah.
But usually, if they get through the first week unscathed, with the roof, you're pretty much fine. And they'll have two roofs by 2020, I think. So then they'll be all set.
So we have day one and a half in the books. No major upsets. Am I correct in that? All our big seeds are through. Our number one, Serena Williams, won on Tuesday. Novak Djokovic winning on Monday.
Andy Murray winning on Tuesday. No major upsets. Roger Federer winning also on Monday.
He had a little bit of a match.
No huge.
He had some tie breaks.
He did. Two tie breaks against a guy who's had a horrible career on grass. Is not good on grass. Not a grass court player.
Yeah.
And he wasn't able to break, really. He played okay. He served okay. When he was asked whether he was 100% or whether he thought he would get to 100%, he essentially said, we'll see. So Roger Federer is not really 100% right now, and maybe he gets that way.
That sounds like a no.
maybe he gets that way by the second week.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's recovering from injuries, and he seems like he's still not quite sure where his fitness is. But we'll see how it plays out.
Djokovic enters this tournament, of course, as the just absolute overwhelming favorite. He is the world number one. He has won the Australian and the French, which you told me off the air that no one's done since Jim Courier. Jumbo Jim Courier.
Been a while.
You look through that bracket, where's the first, potential roadblock or even hassle for Djokovic? Because, it's pretty hard to be a roadblock at this point.
Yeah, tough to be a roadblock. I would say you look at the quarterfinals, and he's looking at Milos Raonic.
Yep.
Huge serve. If he's on and serving tons of aces, he can basically make it so you don't really get to play, which is a good way to beat Djokovic, because when he plays, you probably won't beat him.
Yeah.
And then after that, could be Federer in the semifinals, but that's, if Federer is Federer, then it's a good match. And he was really good last year in the final and still lost, so...
What do players think about playing a big serve player like Raonic? I mean, I have to say that I find him pretty boring. Like, I know that there are aspects of him that are very likable. Now he has John McEnroe joining his team of advisors/coaches. But I just find the heavy serve and sort of the other parts of his game, which aren't terribly polished, I just find it very tedious to watch. But if you have to go play a guy like that, are the guys who end up playing a big serving player like that, are they kind of rolling their eyes like, oh, this is going to be a long day?
They hate it, for sure, because they know that. They absolutely hate it, because you don't get to do anything. I mean, you spend five straight return games and get your racket on three balls, and two of them are miss hits.
Yeah.
It's not fun. And you lose your rhythm, and it puts more pressure on your service game, and you feel like the other guy can swing, just go for broke on your serve, because he knows he's going to hold if he's having a good day.
Yeah.
It's not a great way to sort of figure out how well you're playing.
Let me ask you this. Like, if you tennis took some steps to slow the courts down in an effort to limit the effectiveness of the big servers, the Gorani, Vinicevic's, and so on. If you threw Raonic back in that era, where would that guy be? I mean, he's got an astonishingly strong serve
when court conditions are designed to limit the effectiveness of strong serves. I mean, what would it have been like if he was still in the skidding fast court grass era?
Yeah, indoor, old indoor hard courts, yeah, he'd be pretty dominant. The old grass courts where the bounce wasn't as much.
Yeah.
Too, but I don't know, because the court service thing is so weird to me, because that's what everyone thinks and it's what everyone says, and yeah. I see evidence of it, but no one really knows, because tennis treats science like it's some strange, dangerous thing that you shouldn't do, you know, and nobody has the numbers about what the court surface is made of and how the ball bounces. It's very sort of eyesight thing, and you know.
By the way, science is something very dangerous that you shouldn't do. I'm just letting you know. That's true.
It is true. But nonetheless, some people still do it. The return game has gotten so much better. I'm amazed at how easily someone like Djokovic returns these serves. On a regular surface, on hard courts, I mean, he'll give up. He'll be aced like 10 times by a guy like this, which is ridiculous. So the serve has gotten a lot bigger, but everybody's been able to adapt to it now. Now, if you start getting serves where everybody's serving 165, 170, then, you know, then that's a whole different story. We'll see what happens. But
I mean, a guy like Djokovic, you know, if you were to say, okay, take a year and come back with the mega serve, do you think they could do it? Or do you just think that some people are at the height, the sort of arm length and so on, are built for it better than others? Obviously, big guys like Isner and Raonic, you know, you see it.
I couldn't do it. I mean, I think it's like a, you know, it's like a fastball pitcher. I mean, they're not as big a body.
Yeah.
You'd have to relearn technique. And, you know, really, you don't need it. I mean, if you can serve 125 and hit your spots, then you have everything else. You're not going to lose too many service games.
The other thing, Roscoe Tanner. How tall a guy was Roscoe Tanner? He wasn't terribly tall, was he?
No, he wasn't too big. He had a huge serve, and also his toss, he would just hit it right away. As soon as the ball went up, he would hit it. So it was really deceptive and hard to follow. One thing I think people don't realize, Jason, that's always interesting to me, too, about how tennis changes. Everybody complains you can't serve in volley anymore, this, that, on grass courts because the courts are slow or the returns are so good. It's not really because the courts are slow, at least not fully. They serve too hard.
Yeah.
You can't serve in volley if you hit 135-mile-an-hour serve. There's no time to get to the net. The ball comes back too fast.
Well, but that's on you. Can't you take a little bit off, Tom?
True, and then you get crushed because they're very good at returning, so then it'd be bad.
There was a moment where you almost lost your number two in the women's bracket on Monday. She got taken, Muguruza got taken to the third set and lost, won 6-4 in the third, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. I have to look at the score, but yes, close match.
But not the kind of volatility that we saw early on in the French, at least. You know, I know we're only a day and a half here, but Serena, the presumptive favorite, again, has had a very good year. You had an interesting theory about Serena that, you know, despite all the fuss about 2015 versus 2016, she hasn't posted a slam victory this year. You actually think that there's a case to be made that she's playing even better than she did last year, which is crazy when you think that she won three slams.
I think she's playing at least as well, and actually I do think better. The way she won slams last year, she had a lot of bumpy matches, especially at the French Open last year. It was a disaster. It's amazing that she won that tournament, and Wimbledon was tricky at times too. This year she's really been racing through everybody, and then she got to two finals and played two opponents who played really well and lost, and that's going to happen sometimes.
Yeah.
So I think she's doing fine. I mean, she's just going to have to give herself a few more chances, but I'll be surprised if she doesn't win a couple.
On Wednesday, day three, we see Roger Federer, second-round opponent, a guy named Marcus Willis, the immortal Marcus Willis, who I believe entered the tournament ranked 772nd or something in the tour, which, you know,
which is
at that point,
like,
you know, really, what's the difference?
Ranked 800,000.
What is that? What'd you say?
That's essentially like being ranked 800,000.
Exactly. Oh, wow. He moved all the way up from 772 to 773. But no one's expecting him to win against Federer, but he's a remarkable story. This is a guy who went through qualification and pre-qualification, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. He needed to win six matches just to get into the main draw.
Yeah.
And won his first round match in straight sets. Crazy atmosphere. People going nuts. super funky game that you would see, you know, kind of among players you would play against, although souped up, and, you know, he would never lose a point to players that you play against.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, slices and cuts and little half volleys and, you know, not heavy topspin. The ball's pretty flat. It's amazing to watch. He teaches tennis and lives at home with his parents and has made no money playing tennis whatsoever, and was going to quit until his girlfriend told him, no, you know, you should quit. Keep trying. It's good. Keep trying. You're young. And here he is. It's really been incredible.
Maybe he will be the sports savior that the UK needs this week, Tom. You know, maybe he's the guy who steps into the void and says, I am your next.
In Wimbledon, it would be the greatest run, upset, crazy event in the history of by far, and I give him essentially no chance, but boy, would that be a story.
Listen, in the year of Leicester City, like, who says no to these kinds of things anymore, right?
True, but this is all about one person, not a team.
Yeah. I'll say no. I'll say no.
I'll say no.
Tom Perrotta's with us from the UK. We'll be right back in a minute to talk some more Wimbledon.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. This is Free for All. Now, here's Jason Gay.
I'm joined by Tom Perrotta, who is calling us from not so merry old England, where he is covering Wimbledon, the Wimbledon Championships for the Wall Street Journal. Tom, Wimbledon is on a lot of people's sports bucket list. It's right up there with the Masters, you know, playing at Pebble Beach, you know, stuff like that. Is it all it's cracked up to be? Would you advise somebody who is putting together a sports bucket list to put it on there because it really delivers?
I would. I've been a tennis fan my whole life, so maybe I'm biased, but it's a pretty amazing place. It's a beautiful place. The lawns, the flowers. They've done this great job of
keeping flowers and lawns. Okay, yeah. No.
right. They've done this great job of keeping a very old look, even though they've modernized a lot of things.
Yeah.
The stadiums are not that big. Any seat you have in center court, you can see well.
Yes.
You never feel like you're on the moon like you do, you know, in Arthur Ashe Stadium at the U.S. Open, where it looks like a video game's being played somewhere 1,000 miles below your feet, you know. And the vibe is really incredible. And when it's a nice day, it's a great place to walk around and to watch tennis and have some strawberries. Definitely I would put it on the bucket list.
Now, with the U.S. Open, the advice always is, okay, if you're going to go to the U.S. Open, go early, you know, when you can see as many matches as possible. You can go watch great matches on the far courts, watch some doubles, all kinds of stuff. What's the optimal day, would you say, during the two-week Wimbledon tournament?
Well, early to all the slams. I think early is fine. It's a great way to go. But at Wimbledon, the second Monday, first Monday of the second week, is the best day there is in Grand Slam tennis, probably, because they don't play on Middle Sunday. It's the only Grand Slam that just takes a day off.
Mm-hmm.
So on Monday, everybody plays. Men's and women's draw. It's the entire fourth round.
Yes.
So they're all very good competitive matches all out there at once, and you really don't have that, you know, at any other tournament.
There's not a stinker among them. You get everybody.
You might have a stinker of a match, but you have plenty of other matches to choose from if you do.
And, like, etiquette-wise, you know, when you go to the Masters, I mean, I don't know if it compares closely to the Masters, but, you know, you sort of feel that vibe of you're stepping back in time for good reasons and bad reasons. But there's definitely, like, everyone sort of on their best behavior. They're kind of like, okay, I'm at Augusta National. I'm going to put the phone away. I'm not going to scream like a lunatic. Does Wimbledon sort of raise people's civility because it's such a famously well-mannered place?
Yeah, I see a lot of that. And you see it in the crowd reactions, too. There's not as much taunting. There's not as much, you know, people on cell phones or cell phones ringing. There's not as much shouting in the middle of trying to serve. Not that that happens tons everywhere, but it is pretty civil that way. I would say that definitely happens. The place just feels kind of old, and that's also the audience. Tennis audience is also not that young.
I know. Let's talk about that for a minute because, you know, I feel Wimbledon snuck up on me a little bit this year as a sports fan, which is funny because it's a week later in the calendar because they moved it. But, you know, getting the young people involved, getting the millennials excited about tennis, you know, there's always things that get raised about changing the game. But what about just sort of the idea of encouraging a little more rowdiness? You know, the vibe around the Willis match. Now, listen, I know it's Willis. It's not like you're watching, you know, Roger Federer play, you know, Richard Gasquet. But, you know, it kind of had that fun, like, you know, screaming, yelling, chanting vibe to it. And I love Davis Cup for that reason. You know, can tennis, would it be helped if we encouraged a little bit more of that kind of thing?
There's been debate about it for a while. It could. I don't really know how much it helps because last year I went down to a totally different area, but to Texas to watch Baylor. And they had a new rule in place where you could taunt, you could do whatever you want, no decorum while points are going on, and it was loud and people were taunting, were reading from tennis instructions books on how to hit forehands while people were swinging at forehands. It was really wild. The road team ended up winning anyway. Fun atmosphere, but half the people I talked to said, I hated this. It's so annoying. These people are really crass and they're driving me crazy.
And the players are the other fans.
Great. I can taunt in a tennis match. So, yeah, you could drive as many people away as you attract. To me, if you want to attract young people in the game, you got to get young people to play tennis and be interested in tennis as kids because then they're going to watch it. That's the simplest answer. I'm not saying that's easy to do, but that's the
answer. No, you raise a really good point, which is that, you know, there are still people for whom tennis, they want tennis to be tennis, and they don't want to see it, you know, softened up in ways that sort of make it, like, just more palatable to, you know, millennials or so on. And I can speak for it. I have no problem with the rowdiness of crowds. I love that. But then on the other hand, like, I'm the guy who's like, I can't believe they let them wear non-collared shirts now at Wimbledon. Like, that blows my mind. like I just can't handle it. I'm like, is it too much to ask one of the tournaments, can they have to wear a collared shirt? Is it, can Rafa really wear a muscle shirt out there?
as long as everything's white, it's fine. You know what I would like to see change that could help, I think, the fan experience with these tournaments, all of them? And you can't do it with a super small stadium, but from second level up, say, at the U.S. Open, is lit.
Yeah.
While the match is going on.
Yeah.
You do that. So you don't have to wait in line to get your seat.
I think that's
good. And miss, you know, wait for this match, and you're waiting in line with your hot dog and your soda. It's silly.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to talk a little bit about the idea of a Djokovic calendar slam. Not just a calendar slam, but the idea of a calendar Golden Slam, a la Steffi Graf in 88. You know, it's all on the table for Novak. He's got the first two slams in the book. He's the presumed or the presumptive, you know, favorite here at All England Club. He will be the favorite in Rio. He will be the favorite at the U.S. Open, barring something insane happening. It doesn't feel like a huge stretch. I mean, lots can happen. We see it all the time. But he's got as good a shot as anybody's had for a very, very long time.
It doesn't feel like a huge stretch because if he's healthy and playing well, it takes an absurd performance to beat him.
Yeah.
And he's really just far ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
It's incredible how far ahead he is. Now, that said, people have bad days. People get colds. People twist their ankles. Right. All sorts of things can happen, but he should be pretty relaxed, I would think, at this point after winning the French Open, which is the only one he had never won.
Yes.
That's a big weight off his shoulders. He's won these other ones before.
Yes.
So it definitely can happen.
You think he's going to play Rio? He's not going to be one of these people bowing out?
I think he'll play.
Yeah.
He hasn't, you know, said he's going to bow yet, but I think he'll play. To me, this is his last chance to win a gold medal. Is great now? Is he going to be like this when he's 33? That's a bit of a stretch for anybody.
Yeah. But don't forget, he's Uniqlo, and they're going to want him there in 2020. Let me ask
Fair
you this,
enough,
Tommy.
But he might. but he might not win.
I know. They'll want him there. I was trying to think about the sports person of the year for Sports Illustrated, because, you know, I always like to look out for Sports Illustrated, you know, print magazine. I grew up reading it. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, do the odds for sports person of the year. And, you know, right now in the clubhouse, you got to say, I don't know, Leicester City or LeBron James. But really, if Djokovic does the Grand Slam, even in an Olympic year where we're going to see spectacular things happen, Katie Ledecky could win 5 gold medals or whatever. It just, the reason why I feel a tennis player who does a Grand Slam makes the most compelling case, and by the way, this would be back-to-back tennis players for Sports Person of the Year, is that unlike a LeBron James who has to be good through a specific season but really sort of physically peak in the last like 4 to 6 weeks of it for the playoffs, tennis players, like, to win those slams, you have to, like, peak, come down, peak again, come down, peak. And you have to do it repeatedly. You have to sort of, like, raise your game to the top level, which is not to say that, you know, you win every slam in the same dominant fashion, but it's a level of sort of fitness and periodization that is not called for in any other sport. I guess golf, if you call that physically the same, I would say it was not physically the same, but don't you agree that, like, there's the ask of winning a Grand Slam is unlike anything really in big time sports?
I think so, and I think it would be deserved. All you have to know is that only 2 other men have ever done it.
That's true.
That's not much. and it's been you know, 40 some odd years since the last one, so. Right. Yeah, it would be pretty amazing. Now, would he get it? I don't know. Are they going to give it to 2 tennis players in a row? That's pretty tough competition in an Olympic year.
Yeah.
Serena's also.
They've already given it to LeBron.
In the U.S., but.
So I would think that, like, if you had some sort of crazy stellar Olympic performance, I don't know.
Yeah.
Leicester City.
It'd be tough if you were Novak to say you got robbed by LeBron. That was a pretty amazing performance. But
Iceland soccer.
That would be bigger.
Okay. Iceland soccer team?
If they win the Euro, that would be great.
All right, Tom Parada, thank you very much for joining us from not-so-merry old England. Have a great rest of your Wimbledon.
And you can read all of Tom's coverage from Wimbledon in the Wall Street Journal at WSJ.com and also in good old-fashioned print delivered right to your driveway by reliable delivery people. You've been listening to the free-for-all, as always, here on WSJ Podcasts. Tune into all of the WSJ Podcast Network for incredible verbal information about all the coverage you see every day in the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jason Gay. See you next time.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.